You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
I do really think that the real problem is that it's not that we have a unitary executive, but we have a wayward executive. We have a corrupt executive. We have an executive who defies the law, who fails to execute the laws properly because he doesn't consider himself bound by the laws.
And welcome to George Conway Explains It All to Sarah. I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark, and because I'm not a lawyer, I've asked George Conway from the Society for the Rule of Law to explain all the illegal news to me. Hey, man.
Hey, how are you?
Oh, I'm great. Hey, I heard you got, there were some like guitar people who were very excited about your guitar talk.
Yes, the Bulwark received a message from the general counsel of the Martin Guitar Company because
he's just a listener.
Yeah, he's a listener, and I'm going to ask. My ask is a factory tour someday. I don't know when I'm going to get a chance to do it, but we'll see.
Oh, that's cute. That's cute. All right, George, I'll probably have to bring
some Bulwark merch with me or something.
You do. I'm repping the merch right now. This is my favorite new merch that we have.
Yeah, I heard about the new merch.
This color is called Butter Yellow, and I love it.
Butter Yellow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
All right. We have so much to get to today, guys. We are going to do a speed session. It's going to take us a whole hour, but we're going to get through a lot of content. We are going to start with the big case that on Monday, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in Trump v. Slaughter, a case on whether the president can fire members of the Federal Trade Commission. Now, you may think that sounds boring and you may be like, God, I can't. Why do I have to listen to stuff about the FTC? This is an extremely important case. OK, by way of background, the FTC has five commissioners. They're appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, and they serve 7-year terms. So under the law, currently no more than three commissioners can come from a single political party, and commissioners can only be removed from office for what's cause. That cause being inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office. So this case involves...
Too bad impeachment doesn't work that way.
I know. Too bad, like, you know, inciting an insurrection isn't one of them. Sure. So this case in particular, it involves Rebecca Kelly Slaughter, who was appointed to the FTC by Trump during his first term. So Trump appointed this person and then appointed for a second term on FTC by Biden. But in March of this year, the White House Office of Presidential Personnel emailed Slaughter saying she was being removed from office effective immediately and that her continued service on the FTC is inconsistent with the Trump administration's priorities. And since FTC commissioners can only be removed from office for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office, she sued. So the FTC is one of about two dozen independent agencies established by Congress. So what happens in this case will likely have ripple effects across other agencies too, including potentially the Fed. This goes directly to whether or not Trump can just like fire Jerome Powell or other, other Fed employees. Okay. So the reason I want to talk about it with you is because this case is really focused on the unitary executive theory. Now, I, as a good conservative, understand that the unitary executive theory is a thing, but I don't really understand it. So my first question is, can you explain why conservatives are obsessed with the unitary executive theory? And I want you to cop to whether or not you believe in it too.
Well, I think fundamentally, to me, the most appealing aspect of the unitary executive theory is the Constitution. The Constitution, Article 2, Section 1, basically says that the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States. It doesn't say, and such independent agencies as Congress may from time to time establish, which is what they did in Article 3 with lower courts, for example. And so the notion is that the idea behind the unitary executive is that anybody exercising executive power on behalf of the United States has to be responsive to the president of the United States. And the second piece of it is that in order to be responsive to the United to the president of the United States, that person needs to be fireable at will by the president of the United States, or else they can just go off and do whatever they want. So the problem with the problem with this whole area of case law is that it's been internally inconsistent for a very, very long time. There was a old case in, I forget what year, but a long time ago, called Myers against the United States, where the Supreme Court held that Congress could not restrict the president's power to fire a postmaster. And that's, you know, the idea is, again, the person is exercising power on behalf of the United States, exceeding the laws and doing what he's supposed to be doing under the law. And so the president gets to remove that person without any strings attached. But then years later, Congress created the FTC, which was a multi-member body, and it was designed to engage in consumer protection. And at that time, it was principally kind of, it did adjudicative, what the court described as quasi-legislative and quasi-adjudicative functions and not really executive functions. And President Roosevelt tried to remove one of the members, and the court said, no, you can't do that because this is not really an executive agency. The problem is, it was, or it became one, right? The FTC accreted powers over the years that because Congress gave it more to do, enforcing the antitrust laws, all sorts of things. And so the president, there is this agency that enforces consumer protection, federal consumer protection laws and federal antitrust laws. Now, note that the Justice Department, a footnote, also enforces federal antitrust laws, often the same statutes. But the problem is that the president can't fire these people. He can appoint them. He's got to appoint a certain number of people of the opposite party, and then those people are not removable. So the FTC can kind of do whatever it wants, at least for the F members can do what they want to the extent until the end of their terms. Now, that's arguably inconsistent with Article 2, Section 1. That's the conservative argument. The liberal argument is, well, Congress has been creating multi-member bodies for so many, many years. They created a few of them back in, the Washington or Adams or Jefferson administration, including something to do with war debts. And so it's a little bit unclear whether the framers really meant that the president's power to fire people exercising executive authority can be limited in any way by Congress. But what the court has done over the last, 20 years, I'm not sure exactly how long, has cut back on that second case, the FTC case, which is called Humphrey's Executor against the United States, by saying that, well, the rationale in Humphrey's Executor really isn't about quasi-judicial and quasi-legislative powers. The fact is, it's about whether there's a multi-member agency. You can create specialized multi-member agencies that, you know, that decide things and create regulations and enforce laws. And those the president's removal power can be restricted. But if it's not a multi-member agency, the president can remove the agency official. Problem with that is it's got nothing to do with anything in the Constitution of the United States. It doesn't, it means that you could have an executive, you could have multi-member bodies exercising all sorts of executive power if Congress decided to pass a law and the president signed it into law. Like, for example, here's a good policy reason why Congress might want to do something crazy here. We have a Defense Department where Pete Hegseth is bombing the shit out of people in boats, right? We can't have that. Let's say I'm a congressman. We can't have that. We need a multi-member agency of smart people who know what they're doing and are sober to run the Defense Department and to make sure they're not lickspittles like Hegseth. We're going to make it a multi-member body. So we will have the Federal Defense Commission. And, if there are going to be airstrikes, the president wants to order, it has to go through this body. Now, there's another problem with that, which is the commander-in-chief clause of the Constitution. But theoretically, what keeps Congress from basically taking everything that the president is supposed to do in executing the laws and just creating agencies of multi-member bodies where the agency members can't be fired by the president and basically strip the president? This is the slippery slope argument. Lawyers love slippery slope arguments. Well, if you can do this, then why can't you do that? And if you can't do that, why can't you do all that? And the argument is you could basically completely neuter the president of the United States and basically take away all of the power to execute the laws when in fact the Constitution says the contrary, that the president shall execute the laws. Now, the counter argument is, that Congress has been doing it for a long time. And if you undo this, this is the stare decisis argument that the respondents are making in this case. The argument is like, you're going to just throw all these agencies into chaos, including possibly the Federal Reserve, which is a multi-member agency. So, and that's the slippery slope in the other direction. And the question is, what is the court going to do and whether or not it's going to make any sense? It's clear that three justices at this argument want to uphold Slaughter's appointment and have Slaughter win, and to affirm that Humphrey's executor case. It's pretty clear that there are at least two justices, Alito and those are the liberals, right, who want to maintain Humphrey's executor. And then it's clear, I think, that from looking at the transcript that Alito, well, at least Thomas, for example, maybe not Alito, but Thomas and Gorsuch would overrule Humphrey's executive and basically strike down all of these agencies that you mentioned, the 22 odd agencies, which again would create chaos. And then there's
Can I just pause there? Wait, yeah. You say strike them down. Does that mean get rid of the agencies allow the executive to be in charge?
Yeah, I mean, strike down their independence. I apologize for phrasing it that way. They would strike down their independence by saying that all of these, the FTC, the SEC, and maybe the Fed, and we'll get back to that in a minute, maybe all of these people can be removed by the president without cause, at will. And of course, the biggest problem there is the Fed. It's a very dangerous thing to give any president, let alone this one, complete control of Fed and monetary policy. Congress didn't intend that, and it wouldn't be a good thing. And most central banks have some independence from the executive branch in the Western world. So there's a third possibility that I think what I think is going to happen to this argument is that they're going to rule for the government here, but maintain at least some semblance, continue to kind of amble through with some version of a weakened, whittled down Humphrey's executor, which is what they've been doing for the last 15 or 20 years. And the problem is that sort of just kicks the can down the road because the inherent tension that exists in the law will still exist. Are we really serious that the president could the president's powers could be taken away by a succession of statutes, assuming a president signed them, that would commit executive power to independent agencies. We call them independent agencies because the president can't just remove these people at will. And that problem may persist, and maybe that's the best answer to this case at this time, because the real problem, as I see it, is not the unitary executive theory. I understand why many liberals don't like it. And I understand their argument that, the power to remove wasn't meant to be so strictly applied that it has to happen in every situation where somebody is executing the laws on behalf of the president or on behalf of the United States. But the problem is, what about the Fed? What about this guy? And what is Trump going to do with this power? That's the real problem. The real problem to me, and I think we talked about this in a prior episode, isn't so much the unitary executive theory, because I think I see the logic behind it. And I see the textual support for it in the Constitution. The problem is, this is the last guy.
But that's not how this works.
That power.
But that's not how this works, right?
Right. That's the problem. And that's the problem that the court, by having this messy case law, it just happens to come home to roost at the time when you have an executive who is the most aggressive about expanding his powers. So that's the conundrum faced by the Supreme Court. And specifically, the conundrum really centers, to my mind, on the Fed.
Yeah. So talk to me about the Fed. I want to ask about the Fed, because this is, Trump is jonesing to fire the people at the Fed who won't cut interest rates, to run the economy hot, to lower interest rates so that he can get around the fact that his tariffs are killing everybody. Okay. This is like a thing he desperately wants to do. And they're going to hear the case in a month.
Yeah. There's some suggestion in the oral arguments that some of the justices, I forget which ones, but the ones in the middle, I think, are going to be the key justices on what I think Trump is going to win this case. The administration is going to win this case. The question is whether they win it in a sweeping fashion that allows Trump to fire everybody on all these agencies, including the Fed, or whether they're just going to keep kind of ambling along with this inconsistency in the case law. And they're just going to say, well, we're going to overrule specifically with respect to the FTC, but we're not saying anything about any other agency. And the problem is, Justice Kagan rightly pointed out at the oral argument, is, well, you can put a footnote in any opinion saying that the general rule and the rationale that we apply in this case doesn't apply to A, B, and C. But why? Okay, why? And that's the problem. There's no good answer to this case. And the problem with it is, if you give the purest answer, the purest conservative answer, which is the text says the executive power shall be vested in a president. That's what it means. Therefore, he can fire everybody, which is kind of that was a Scalia view. And it's appealing in its logic, because you have, it's executive power. It doesn't say anybody else can execute executive power. It says the president. Now, the president can act through agents who he appoints and can fire. So the problem is, what about the Fed? To go back to it, that's the scary part. It doesn't scare me. If they got rid of the FTC, it wouldn't scare me. I mean, it's bad. It's bad enough that this president is in charge of the Justice Department and everything else. Adding the FTC to the situation isn't necessarily, it's not great, but it's not the end of the world. The Fed, on the other hand, that's scary. And I think maybe they can figure out a way to distinguish the Fed by saying that, they can't really decide the Fed case. They can, because it's not before them.
It will be in a month, but that
case really involves, in that case, the government is arguing that there was cause. But the thing about the Fed is, there are functions that I'm not sure are executive. Setting monetary policy, I don't know whether that's actually executive. It's banking. And we have to have a, you know, every major country has a national bank. It's not, they're not executing laws in the sense they're being a bank, a central bank, albeit on behalf of the U.S. government, authorized by the U.S. government to conduct, do things that a central monetary authority does. But you know, they could say and split the baby. And I don't know if this really makes a lot of sense, that some of the Fed's regulatory functions are executive, and figure out a way to cleave those off. Basically say that the Fed can't exercise that authority, or you can fire them with respect to that authority. I don't know how you do that. But it can be a bank. It can be a central bank. I don't even know if that makes sense. And, you know, this is a mess. That's the bottom line. And I do really think that the real problem is that it's not that we have a unitary executive, but we have a wayward executive. We have a corrupt executive. We have an executive who defies the law, who fails to execute the laws properly because he doesn't consider himself bound by the laws.
So again, so not a lawyer that it's literally a central thesis of this podcast, but it seems to me that the question of when the Supreme Court gave Trump basically carte blanche to do whatever he wanted within anything that's an executive function, no matter what he does, he cannot be held accountable for it. That was the Rubicon that got crossed.
I don't disagree.
But
with
if
that,
you're going to, but if you're going to believe in the unitary executive theory, then it's going to apply to whoever the American people want. And so for people who like the unitary executive theory, I guess you have to pressure test that with,
what if
the worst person in the world is the president?
President Sanders or something. And he decided to do things that you don't like, Mr. MAGA. That's the way it's supposed to work. You're supposed to think about, what if the shoe is on the other foot? That's the whole idea behind the rule of law. It's like, okay, you can't just apply a constitutional provision or statutory provision one way when it's being, and you know, read a certain way by people that you like or who are doing things that you like, and then to say, uh-oh, when the other guys get in, they can't do their own thing with respect to the same power. It's not supposed to work that way. It's supposed to be neutral. But this is a real conundrum of a tension in the case law that has existed for decades and has been becoming more apparent over the last couple of decades. And it happens to be coming to roost now at the worst possible moment, at the moment where you have a fundamentally lawless president, and you have to be fearful about giving him any more rope. And that's sort of, you know, and that's kind of a modified stare decisis argument to my mind, because you don't want to, you know, I mean, you don't want to upset the apple cart too much. There may be some errors that you think that your court made in the past that you want to kind of fix and modify. But if you overturn something so drastically, and I think of the abortion case as an example, you can create a lot of chaos and a lot of political instability. And doing that now, in the context of having this president given additional authority to fire people, is a little bit scary. On the other hand, I have to say the law makes no sense as it is. So it's not great.
All right. Before we move on to our next topic, this show is sponsored by Superpower. Every year, billions of dollars are spent on gifts that gather dust. Not gifts that I give, because my gifts are awesome. But the greatest gift isn't something you wear or display. It's feeling your best, George. Superpower helps your loved ones take control of their health so they can feel better, live longer, and have more time with you. If you want to say to your loved ones, I want you around for a long time, Superpower is for you. Superpower is a new kind of health platform that helps you get answers about what's really happening inside your body and what to do about it. One simple lab test measures 100 plus biomarkers like hormones, metabolism, vitamins, minerals, thyroid, heart health, and more. They'll get a full health report and a personalized action plan built by clinicians, including nutrition, supplement, and lifestyle guidance. For just $199, every gift membership comes beautifully packaged in a free superpower gift box, which has a $49 value, ready to wrap and give. It's a thoughtful, life-changing gift for your partner, parents, or even yourself. Superpower not only gives you an initial plan, but it tracks your results over your lifetime. Each test builds on the last, giving you a full picture of your progress year after year. Give your loved ones something that actually lasts. Better health and more time with you. Go to superpower.com/gift to get a free $49 premium gift box with your gifted membership. After you sign up, they'll ask you how you heard about them. Please mention this podcast and support the show. Okay, now we're on to the Texas redistricting. The hits just keep on coming here. A 3-judge district court had blocked newly drawn district maps in Texas on the ground that they were the product of unconstitutional racial gerrymandering. The district's court opinion prevented Texas from using the new maps in the 2026 midterms. The state of Texas asked the Supreme Court to stay the district court's ruling, which it did. This means that the new maps can be used while the district court opinion is on appeal, including during the 2026 elections, assuming the appeal is not resolved by then, which I assume it won't be. So Justice Kagan wrote a scathing dissent and was joined by Sotomayor and Jackson. This decision is particularly important because the new congressional map in Texas could give Republicans in Texas up to 5 additional seats. The Supreme Court, in its opinion, said the district court improperly inserted itself into an active primary campaign, causing much confusion and upsetting the delicate federal-state balance in elections. But of course, as the Supreme Court also interfered in the election process with its stay, as Kagan pointed out in her dissent, the majority calls its evaluation of this case preliminary. The results, though, will be anything but. This court stay guarantees that Texas's new map, with all its enhanced partisan advantage, will govern next year elections for the House of Representatives. And this court stay ensures that many Texas citizens, for no good reason, will be placed in electoral districts because of their race. And that result, as this court has pronounced year in and year out, is a violation of the Constitution. So it sounds like, based on Kagan's dissent, that this stay is likely to be in place 10 months from now when the elections happen. Or is there a chance the appeal will be resolved by then?
I think the appeal will be resolved by the time of the primary. But what the court is clearly telegraphing here is that the plaintiffs are going to lose. And I have to say, I don't understand what the court, the majority, did here. I completely understand Kagan's dissent, and I think it's persuasive, just as I thought the Fifth Circuit decision was persuasive. I mean, but here's the law in a nutshell. The law is that political gerrymandering is not something the court will mess with, because it's just something that they view it as something that legislatures do, whether or not you like it, whether or not you think it's good policy. It's not unconstitutional, and there's no law against it. On the other hand, you can't discriminate on the basis of race. That's what the Constitution provides, that through the Equal Protection Clause. And the Voting Rights Act says that you cannot, there are other circumstances where racial actions can be inferred on the basis of the evidence, but this isn't one of them. This is a case where the district court cited an abundant degree of evidence to show that the Texas legislature, when it drew these congressional maps, was very consciously taking race into account. In fact, was doing so at the behest of the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights of this administration, who is basically taking the position in order to get Texas to engage in racial gerrymandering, was saying, taking the position that the districts were already racially gerrymandered, even though she provided no evidence that they were. And so the upshot was Texas took this and ran with it. Now, it may be that they were motivated by partisan advantage, because if you racially gerrymander districts, that can help Republicans, because you could concentrate all the Black people, say, or the Hispanic people into one district, then you'd have all these other white districts around it. Or if you chopped up the black people or the Hispanic people and spread them out, you know, and creating these funny spoke-like districts. Just, I'm just making up, you know, hypothetical maps. You could also make that, you could, maybe you could create a situation where there were no, you know, Democratic districts in an extreme case. So, the problem is what Alito's concurrence, first of all, there was just a 2-page order unsigned by the court. And then Alito wrote a very, very short, unsigned order. And then Alito wrote a very short concurrence saying, and basically 3 or 4 quick sentences, the district court was wrong because of A and B. And what A was that he said, oh, this wasn't racial gerrymandering. The court, this was just partisan gerrymandering. But the problem is partisan gerrymandering and racial gerrymandering are not mutually exclusive. You can engage in partisan, if you engage in sufficient race conscious gerrymandering, you can have an effect on the partisan effects. You can have an effect on what the partisan result is from a political party standpoint. And if they had done so, if Texas had redrawn these districts for political purposes with blinders on as to who, what races the people were and where they lived, that would be one thing. I don't know how that would happen, but that would be one thing. But the record, as explained by the district court, who went through the record very carefully and it's documented, found that they were explicitly considering race. And the Supreme Court has said that's illegal. So if this 2-page concurrence by Alito is taken seriously, it's going to mean that all you have to say is, oh, we were just doing it because we wanted more Republican representatives. They can engage in racial gerrymandering.
Because, well, it's not really racial gerrymandering when they use race, even though they use race to create a partisan advantage. But they didn't do it because they were racist. They were doing it because they wanted the partisan advantage. But the problem is that's not what the statute says. The statute basically, you can't consider race. That's how it's been interpreted, I think, correctly by the Supreme Court. So I, for the life of me, I can't understand what they did here other than, I mean, I don't want to question their motives, but it doesn't make any sense to me, especially in the face of that opinion. But Kagan makes 2 more points, which I strongly agree with. One is, we talked about the idea that, the Supreme Court took to task the district court for interfering with the political process. There is a so-called principle of the Purcell principle that shows up in the Supreme Court's cases based upon a case named Purcell. It says courts have to be leery of last minute changes to maps. Okay. So, because it creates chaos. Problem is, we're not even close to the last minute. It is 2025. It is not 2026. There are months to go here. And, Kagan is absolutely right in her dissent saying that the Purcell principle, whether or not you agree with it, the notion that you don't want to interfere with elections at the last minute, even if you think there's some legal error in the way the maps are constructed or where some voting regulation is applied, it's not the last minute. There's plenty of time to fix the problem if there's a problem, which the district court found. That's one problem. That's one additional rationale that Kagan had. The other was the Supreme Court's actually supposed to defer to what district courts who have the record and have trials and hear the evidence find. It, as she points out, if it's plausible, what the district court found is factually plausible based upon the record, then the court really, as the Supreme Court of the United States, as an appellate court engaging the proper standard of appellate review, they're not supposed to overturn that. They're supposed to be pronouncing what the law is as applied to the facts as found by the district court, unless there is clear error. And I don't, I read the opinion. I read the shitty dissent in the Fifth Circuit. And clear error does not appear on those pages. It looks perfectly well rationalized. And if they're going to assert that the district, if the Supreme Court is going to make a decision like this and assert that the Fifth Circuit and the district court got it all wrong, well, they should be explaining that instead of just issuing this order overturning these maps indefinitely, pending a decision on the merits, by just saying in one sentence, oh, the district court was wrong. And Kagan is absolutely right. And we've talked about this before, you know, about how all these lower court judges, Republicans and Democrats, are pissed off at the Supreme Court because the court is just going off and assuming facts on its own sometimes, or it seems, and not really paying attention to the careful work that the district judges are doing in parsing through the record. And the court, as I think I've said this now several times, the court's not well equipped to do that. I mean, this was done over a holiday weekend, and you have nine justices. It's not conducive. The way the Supreme Court works is not conducive to making factual findings, which is why, in the wisdom of the ages, appellate courts have always deferred to the factual findings of lower courts, unless they're just wacko.
Yeah, I mean, look, I try to take a pretty, not neutral, but I am circumspect often. I try to get like my hair on fire about the Supreme Court, but I just don't actually see how this could be anything other than putting the scale, like a thumb on the scale for Republicans in the election. Like, you could talk me down. Maybe you don't want to say that. But
I don't want to say it. I hate saying that. I mean, I even didn't like saying it about Eileen Cannon, but, you know, she was the worst.
Yeah. So just the last question on this, just short, but they're also, is this going to apply to like California?
Well, that sort of is the test. It's going to be a little bit of a test there, isn't it? Right? You're going to see, do they apply the law in a neutral fashion to a Democratic state engaging in redistricting between, you know, between decennials, mid-cycle. I mean, I like think of cycle as 2 years, but this is a cycle of 10 years in terms of redistricting. Are they going to apply the same level of scrutiny to a decision that goes in favor of Republican plaintiffs challenging California maps?
We shall see.
And that's one of the criticisms that people have, like Steve Vladeck, who has been the most outspoken about the shadow docket. That's been one of the criticisms, the fact that they don't provide rationales and that they do these things on the fly and that they sometimes ignore factual findings of the lower courts when issuing these shadow docket emergency application decisions. Leads them are, you know, they apply, a lot of people believe, and I don't think I can contradict them, that this court applies more scrutiny to decisions that go in favor of, you know, that go in favor of Democrats.
This show is sponsored by IndaCloud. Every year seems to end the same. More opinions, less peace. This time, reach for calm you can sip. IndaCloud is your online cannabis dispensary for quieting the noise. Gummies, curated flower, pre-rolls, and now zero sugar, zero calorie THC sodas. All federally legal THC, DEA certified, lab tested, shipped discreet, because some headlines deserve to be ignored, and some days deserve bubbles. The first time I tried IndaCloud, I realized silence is the best headline. I've got a couple big projects going on right now that I need to turn off my brain from. Now, I add a THC soda to the mix, the same calm as the gummies, just a bit faster. First time my producer heard about IndaCloud, he thought it was another VPN sponsoring the show. But this is how adults log off, mindfully and maybe with a little bit of fizz. If you're 21 or older, visit IndaCloud.co and use code AskGeorge. For 25% off plus free shipping. That is IndaCloud.co, code AskGeorge for 25% off, free shipping, and one less headline in your head. But as always, enjoy responsibly. Thanks to IndaCloud for sponsoring today's much needed quiet. All right. Now that we've done the bummer Supreme Court stuff, we can get to some good news. You know, Letitia James. They tried to indict her again, grand jury in Virginia, but they declined to reindict New York Attorney General Letitia James. Folks will remember that a few weeks ago, the first criminal case against James was dismissed because Lindsey Halligan was illegally appointed U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia. That dismissal was without prejudice, which meant the U.S. attorney could present it to a new grand jury a second time and try to get a new indictment. Less than 2 weeks later, the U.S. attorney did just that, but the grand jury said no and declined the indictment. George, it is extremely rare for a grand jury to decline to indict. Yeah,
there's an old adage.
About a ham sandwich, right?
About, yes, Judge Saul Wachler, chief judge of the New York Court of Appeals, once said a few decades ago, that prosecutors get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. And maybe that's not true in literal terms, but it is very, 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 very rare for prosecutors to take a proposed indictment to a federal grand jury and get it no-billed by the grand jury. That's just hard to do. And they managed to do it here. And what's really crazier about it is they seem to be saying they're going to go back and try it again with another grand jury. And I have to say, I mean, what this does is maybe they'll get the indictment next time. Maybe they'll find 24 people who don't care about what they're voting on or didn't see what happened in the newspapers, or they just get lucky. But this just boosts Letitia James, Attorney General James's arguments about selective and malicious prosecution. It just puts it into hyperdrive.
Yeah, because they can't go like grand jury shopping, right?
Well, yeah, you don't normally do that. Nobody does that. And I mean, there's no rule against it, but that's very common in the law, that there's no rule against things that are so stupid nobody thinks there ought to be a rule against it. Okay. because who would do that? And if they're doing that, and all they're doing is showing that they're treating this woman differently for some reason than everybody else who they fail to get indictments against, which is actually a rare thing. So this case is going nowhere. They may try again. Maybe they'll get it is just pure utter harassment and an embarrassment to the Republic that this case is being brought.
Does she have recourse at any point? Like, if they can, she countersue for harassment, or
you know, in theory, there could be a civil rights claim. I think in theory for malicious prosecution, on maybe under, I don't know. It's really hard. It's really hard to sue.
It just seems like this
there's
is
some
nuts.
Theory, but it's completely wacko. It is completely wacko.
That they can just like keep trying to bring charges just to keep.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, there ought to be a rule
miserable.
Against it. But as I said, no. Why would you have a rule against something that's so stupid nobody would ever do it except these guys? But that's sort of the problem, is like, we're going to have, you know, after these guys are gone, which hopefully will be not in the not too distant future. I don't know. God help us if they're not. We're going to need rules against all sorts of things that we had never thought we needed rules against.
Speaking of people who are not behaving smartly, Alina Habba resigned yesterday as the U.S.
Habba
attorney
no
the
job.
District. Habba no Jabba.
Habba lost the case.
Yeah.
Habba don't.
The District of New Jersey. Her resignation comes after months of legal battles over her position. As you might remember, Habba was Trump's personal lawyer that he appointed to the U.S. attorney role. The president's appointment of any U.S. attorney lasts only 120 days in order to stay in the position. The Senate has to confirm the nominee. Habba didn't get confirmed, but stayed anyway, which led the federal district court to rule back in August that she was unlawfully serving as U.S. attorney. The Third Circuit Court of Appeals upheld that ruling last week, and Habba finally resigned from the position on Monday. But AG Bondi tweeted, of course, that DOJ plans to appeal the ruling, and it appears that Habba isn't done with her government service just yet, because Habba says she's going to rule as a senior, going into a role as a senior advisor to Pam Bondi. So that's
cool. But she haven't no idea how to try a case.
Well, here is the thing that's interesting to me about this. besides the fact that it's fun to dunk on her. So they ruled, right, that she's unlawfully serving as U.S. attorney since July. So, like, she has all these criminal and civil cases that were brought by the U.S. attorney's office since then that she, like, signed off on. Are those cases all invalid now?
Not necessarily. If there were other people on the indictments, maybe you can argue. Maybe you can argue that they're valid. I don't know. I think the funny thing about this is the truly funny thing about this is this is a classic Trump era motif where somebody gets fired or somebody gets ordered not to do something or gets removed from a job because they're illegally there. And they say, you can't do that to me. I quit. That's basically what she did here. And what's doubly funny about it is okay, if Hava no longer claims that she has this job because she resigned the job, even though she never had it, what's there left to litigate? Why isn't the case moot? She resigned. Even if the Supreme Court of the United States took this case, which I doubt it will, and reversed the Third Circuit and said, wait a minute, Hava job, because Hava was legally appointed, which they're not going to hold and they're not going to take the case, she resigned. It's just, you know, you should argue that in court. That sounds good. They have no brains.
But here's, okay, so you don't know if it invalidates it, because this is what I was thinking about was she's not the only U.S. attorney whose appointment has been challenged, right? As we mentioned a few minutes ago, a court recently ruled that Lindsay Halligan.
Yeah, they had problems in other districts. Yeah, they have a problem in California. They had a problem one, I think, in Arizona. They had a problem in upstate New York because they've been doing all sorts of screwy shit to get their people in, people that they think may not be confirmable.
Yeah. So there's all these people that are not, it's dubious at best whether or not. But this is a question of, like, the indictments that they've signed off on, will they still be valid?
I think the argument is going to be by the government that if there were lawfully appointed assistant U.S. attorneys who were authorized to prosecute cases and their names were on the indictment and they helped, you know, because the U.S. attorney does not normally herself go into the grand jury room to secure indictments. Okay. That's not what a U.S. attorney does. U.S. attorney manages the office. They make big policy decisions. They deal with, like, difficult decisions to charge, or to settle cases. And then they hold press conferences to announce what their office is doing. They don't normally go into court and they don't normally go into grand juries. And if a couple of assistant U.S. attorneys went into the grand jury and presented it otherwise lawfully, and they are authorized to practice, authorized to represent the U.S. Department of Justice, then I think the argument is going to be on behalf of the government that what difference does it make? And they may be right.
Got it.
And at a minimum, all they have to do is they can bring these cases and present them once again to the grand jury. Which would be, you know, in these cases, if they're real cases, unlike the Letitia James case, you know, I don't think I'd have a problem with. I mean, the real problem is that the government, that the Trump administration created this problem for itself and for the administration of this office and the administration of justice by engaging in shenanigans and trying to appoint a thoroughly unqualified person who can't even, according, you know, in the E. Jean Carroll case, didn't even know how to move a document into evidence in a civil case. They point this completely incompetent and unqualified person to become a U.S. attorney. And that's, they created the mess. And the people, what?
Do you know how he met Alina Haba and Lindsay Halligan? Do you know why Trump knows them?
I don't know. I'm afraid to ask.
They were beauty queens. They were like, that's what they were like. These former beauty queens that he met at Mar-a-Lago.
I have no idea.
You look like you should be a district attorney, I guess.
I'm not going to go there. You can go there. I'm not going to go there.
I said what I said. All right.
I'm not taking any risks anymore.
This show is sponsored by The Perfect Jean.
Yay.
It's hot guy winter, and the perfect jean is your uniform. The perfect jean has redefined what jeans can be. No more frozen stiff denim, no more crushed chestnuts, No more saggy snow butt. Oh, God. And no no denim-induced seasonal depression. Just soft, stretchy perfection that feels as good as holiday pajamas, but looks date night ready.
Who wrote that copy?
Six fits. Waist 26 to 52, lengths 26 to 38, over 5,000 ways to find your perfect fit. Over 500,000 guys have made the switch. That's more than the population of the North Pole, give or take a few elves, Connor. The switch includes the guys in my shop. The producer who wrote this, oh, it was Connor, owns like six pairs. They're super comfortable when you're in the office every day, as my guys are. It was definitely Connor. He's taking a dig. Yeah, we're in the office every day. I'm glad their jeans are comfortable. They need to sit in them. These jeans make such a good gift, they might actually fix family tension. They're the gift that keeps on stretching and forgiving holiday eating decisions. This holiday season, slay responsibly, but look damn good while doing it. Our listeners get 15% off their first order plus free shipping at theperfectjean.nyc or Google The Perfect Jean and use code ASKGEORGE15 for 15% off. George, you love your perfect jeans.
I do. I wear them all the time, I confess.
I know. You have a lot of pairs of perfect jeans.
I have a lot of pairs.
This is what all the guys in my office now own the perfect jean. Okay. Thanks, perfect jean. All right. I want to get to some breaking news. Epstein grand jury, last topic before we close out. So earlier today, today being Tuesday that we're taping, a federal judge in New York granted DOJ's request to lift the seal on grand jury materials from the investigation and prosecution of Ghislaine Maxwell, which will allow the government to release grand jury transcripts and other records, which is like just evidence from the case. The judge relied on the Epstein Transparency Act as the basis for his decision. The act, which was signed into law last month, requires DOJ to disclose Epstein-related materials. DOJ now has until September 19th to make the materials public and must protect the identities of victims and any materials it releases. So the courts, George, including this federal judge, previously upheld the confidentiality of Epstein grand jury materials and refusal to lift the seals. What about the Epstein Transparency Act changed things? So why can Congress override the grand jury secrecy?
Well, Congress, a statute would override grand jury secrecy because the grand jury secrecy is just a rule enacted by the courts by Congress or issued by the Judicial Conference of the United States by authorization of Congress, and Congress can basically say we're going to trump that, and that's essentially what the court recognized that Congress did it in passing the Epstein Files Transparency Act or whatever it's called. And in light of the fact that these things are now required by the Justice Department, which has possession of copies of these things that are presented to the grand jury, is now required by a federal statute to produce these things, the judge said that, I'm not going to stand in the way of this, but I want to make darn sure that you make sure that all of the victims' names are redacted, which is also consistent with the statute and what the statute requires. And he said that the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Jay Clayton, has to certify that they've redacted the victims' names. It's just a straightforward application of the law that now says that these files have to become public.
So there were multiple grand juries. So when this starts, right, when they start unsealing the grand jury material, is there going to be a lot there? Or can Trump now, can't he hold back certain things?
Well, again, this is what we talked about this previously when the act was first passed, I think. And he should not be able to restrict any of this stuff from coming out. He may drag his feet somehow. I don't know what exactly they're going to do, because I just can't believe that they're, after all of the fighting about this, that they're just going to produce things cooperatively. Although, you know, the one other interesting thing about the Alina Habba situation is they kind of gave in there. They kind of basically acceded to the courts there, which is not what they've been normally doing a lot. What they've been doing is engaging in what some people have called some kind of like
legalistic non-acquiescence, like disobeying the rules, but pretending, disobeying court orders, but pretending to obey them. But, you know, maybe they will comply here as well. I just somehow don't think they will. I mean, there's been a lot of speculation. I think we discussed it about how one thing they might do is just say, well, because the president has ordered Pam Bondi to investigate the likes of Bill Clinton and people he doesn't like for their involvement with Epstein, but of course not himself. There's a provision that says that the materials can be withheld on that ground. But the problem with that is all that means is that the Bill Clinton stuff wouldn't come out if there were any, or the whoever, stuff about whoever, and the stuff about Trump would come out because there's no investigation of Trump's involvement with Epstein. So it shouldn't really help him. So I don't know exactly what they're going to do. I will say this, though, about the grand jury materials. I suspect, I would bet that the grand jury materials are only a small sliver of what is in the possession of the U.S. Department of Justice, because when they bring cases to a grand jury, they're boiling it down. First of all, they don't have to present all the evidence that they're going to present at trial, because they don't have to prove anything beyond a reasonable doubt in front of a grand jury. And secondly, it's like you conduct a multi-year investigation with literally, they involve hundreds and hundreds of victims. Okay, maybe they didn't investigate each situation as thoroughly as some of the ones that they ultimately presented to trial. I think they presented four women victims at trial. But again, they pare the case down to the most egregious facts, the circumstances that were going to be most appalling to a jury. And that's, you know, at the end, that's a sliver of what they must have from an extensive investigation that lasted so many years.
Now that this act has been passed, what does that mean for DOJ, though? Why doesn't this also make DOJ have to just turn everything over?
Well, I mean, the judge doesn't have jurisdiction to do that. This judge is only deciding what happened in the case that was tried before him in his court. No, I know the judge does,
but I'm saying now that Congress passed this Transparency Act, what does that mean for DOJ?
The DOJ should be producing everything, basically, subject to redactions. They don't really have a leg to stand on in holding anything back. I mean, the only possible thing, as I mentioned, is, well, if they're conducting investigations of people other than Trump, well, all that would mean is they still have to produce the stuff about Trump and not produce some of the stuff about other people, which kind of would be not what Trump would want, I think.
That makes sense. Well, we'll have to see where this one goes.
Yeah, we'll see.
I guess next week is still not the 19th, so we won't have that information. But we will keep an eye on it because, as you know, I'm obsessed with the Epstein stuff. George, thanks as always for talking about the illegal news with me. Guys, don't forget to hit subscribe, leave us a review, and we'll see you next week.
Well, George Conway, he's a man with a plan. Got to sit down with Sarah Longwell, take a stand, explain all the legal problems they're piling high. With Donald Trump, oh my, oh my, oh my. He said, Sarah, let me break it down for you. There's obstruction of justice, corruption too, the legal tangles and troubles, they're growing fast. It's a storm that's gonna last and last. Oh, Conway, tell them well about it. Those legal problems can't live without it. From the emoluments to the Russian ties. Oh, Sarah, listen close.